And for those of you that are new listeners, I'm going to give you a quick tutorial for how to use this podcast. When you hear the bell ding, that means that you should look on your device to see what paper we're referencing to back up what we're saying. But if you hear the turkey gobble, that's just our opinion, and you can decide whether or not you want to take it or leave it.
Well, you
except
can tell
today.
Everybody.
No, this
yeah,
month,
you can tell
we're going to do something
everybody.
A little special.
Go ahead and tell everybody. I'm the man, I'm the man, I'm the man. Yes, I am, yes, I am, yes, I am. I'm the man, I'm the man, I'm the man. I believe every lie that I ever told. Paid for every heart that I ever stole. I played my cards and I didn't fold. Well, it ain't that hard when you got sold.
June always means the end of an era and a fresh start for all of us in academics. We say goodbye to a wonderful group of seniors and hello to a fresh group of interns. People go on vacation, gear up for the new year, and we here at AZMcast are going to bring our fourth season to a close. I can think of no better way to close out with something rich to digest over the summer as you go into your new jobs. So we've compiled a series of Rosenisms, both old and new, for you to think on while you're away. Yes, technically it is a clip show, but hey, we need vacations too, right? So seniors, it's been fun. Good luck and thank you for everything you put into your time here. Residents staying on, you are close, so soak up all the knowledge, experience, and advice that you can. And interns, get ready for the best job that exists, medical or otherwise. So this entire episode is not going to have peer review, not going to have evidence-based, because these are the musings and opinions of the man who arguably started the specialty 45 years ago. So this entire episode is respectfully given the turkey gobble. And without much further ado, the wisdom and musings of Dr. Peter Rosen.
Yes, I am, yes, I am, yes, I am. I'm the man, I'm the man, I'm the man.
Peter, I heard you speak about a year or so ago about something I wanted to ask you a bit more about. You said that you don't mind taking care of drug-seeking patients. You don't mind taking care of patients that are malingering, but you have the thing that really gets you down is the somatizers, the people who come in and they can't separate their emotional or social issues from their physical pain. Do you remember kind of that discussion that you had?
Yes, I was talking about how to survive in emergency medicine over time, and that one of the key tasks is to identify the patients you hate and figure out how to take care of them, because you can't escape them. And for me, the group that has given me the most frustration and trouble are the somatizers. And I guess as I learned how to take care of them, I began to figure out why it is that they frustrated me so much and made me so angry. And the reason is that they really defy all of the missions of medicine, that if we can summarize them, cure disease when possible, alleviate it when possible, and give comfort. Well, I suppose the third is still part of taking care of a somatizer, but they need a different kind of comfort, and I think until I realized what it was, that was partially where the frustration was coming from. I think you have to separate somatizers from patients who have addiction and from patients who have chronic pain syndromes, because I think that the management of those patients is quite different, and the problem is a quite different one. We tend to get angry with the addictive patient because they want us to do things that we aren't prepared to do, such as give them large quantities of addictive drugs. And it's hard to know what they do with those drugs. Nobody needs 800 tablets of Vicodin. So my guess is they probably keep enough of them to keep their opiate level where they're comfortable and sell the rest. But whatever they do with it, it doesn't matter, because the secret to their management is to not enter their delusional system. And don't think you have to fight with them. You don't make it a clash of egos. You make it a rule-driven process that you are subject to just as much as they are. In other words, you don't care how much Vicodin they get, but the people who make the rules do, and you have to live under them just as much as they do.
It's not me. It's unknown entity upstairs.
It's them. Yeah. Okay, and that way it takes it away from me versus you, and I'm not giving you what you need from me. So that diffuses the anger and a lot of the hostility. The patients with chronic pain syndromes have a different problem. They frequently have a disease that started the pain that has either been taken care of or is not capable of being taken care of, and they're going to continue to have pain. And the problem with those patients is that who knows how to define pain? It's different for everybody. It's probably different within an individual depending upon what you do. You well know that when you're distracted that you are basically anesthetic to large parts of your body. So similarly with pain, the more you focus on it, the more it bothers you, and the more you ignore it, the more it is something that you can live with. And as you get older, you seem to be less bothered by pain, perhaps because you've had so much in your life, or because perhaps you just get used to it and it doesn't bother you so much. But those are different problems. Now, the somatizer, I don't truly understand. I find that it may be part of the psychiatric syndrome known as conversion reaction, whatever that is caused by, and there doesn't seem to be much help in the psychiatric literature as to what causes it, how to identify it, or how to treat it. And I think that's the problem with the somatizer, is that one way to recognize it is when the patient complains of a series of signs and symptoms that is so unfamiliar that it doesn't immediately suggest a disease to you. When you are a young physician, almost every patient is like that, until you begin to experience enough disease entities that you can recognize a variety of presentations. But after you've been around the track a few times, when you have a patient who presents with a complex of signs and symptoms that to you is unrecognizable, think somatizing. Now, why do they develop this? I simply have never been able to fathom. I've read a fair bit about some of the somatizing diseases like fibromyalgia. My favorite paper on fibromyalgia was called "Fibromyalgia, Is It the Real Thing?" And it proceeds to describe an entity that has no consistent signs and symptoms, that has no objective physical findings, that has no identifiable imaging studies or laboratory tests, and that has no consistent therapy, and then concludes it's the real thing. And to me, that's nonsense. If you don't have those things, how can it possibly be a disease? And then when you look at the patients who present with it, what you discover is similar to the patient with a conversion reaction. There's a great deal of secondary gain going on through the illness. That patient is more than likely manipulating family members, co-workers, the people with whom that patient has to interact. And that probably has something to do with why there is a need to be chronically ill. And so the aim of the patient has to be understood if you're going to do anything for providing the comfort that you would like to give to a patient. And the aim of the somatizer is to be sick as often and as prolonged and in as difficult fashion as possible. The natural history is that there are frequent presentations which increase in number during vacation and during holidays and during other times of family gatherings. There is a clear use of multiple physicians there is a clear need to have multiple hospitalizations, extensive and expensive workups, and a total befuddlement of the medical staffs who cannot, quote, ever find the answer or help me. There is, in combination with this, often a total inability to accept common pain relievers. There is an unbelievable incidence of allergies to every pain medicine, which I find understandable only when I put it into the equation of the patient wants to be ill rather than well. So I think that the first goal of medicine is unmeetable in this patient. They don't have a disease that's recognizable, they don't have a disease that's curable, and they don't have a disease that's treatable. So what do they want? They, in fact, want to be told they have a problem that's not fixable. And that goes against everything that we learn how to do and why we're taught our mission is to be. But until you find that, there's no way to deal with these patients. So I generally approach the somatizer with, you have big problems, and they nod. And I say, you've seen multiple physicians, and they nod and give you an incredible number. And none of them have ever been able to identify or fix your problems, and they nod. And so then I invoke the stupidity law, which is, I'm just a stupid emergency physician. Compared to those doctors that you've seen, I don't know anything. There's no possible way I'm going to be able to solve your problems. But nevertheless, how can I help you get through the day? And usually that's all that's necessary. I've had several somatizers who'd come to the emergency department only when I was on duty, simply because they liked interacting with me because I told them that they had unfixable problems and they just needed to talk about their problems for 10 or 15 minutes, and that was fine. So once I learned how to do that, I became much less hostile to them and much less frustrated by them. And I think that the difficulty is in recognizing who has a chronic disease and who has a somatizing syndrome. Now, there are patients who have chronic diseases that overlap with chronic pain syndrome, such as patients with relapsing pancreatitis. And they often don't carry the laboratory tests, abnormalities that you would think would be associated with a flare-up of the disease. Those patients are difficult, but they probably have organic pathology. And if you could figure out how to get rid of that pancreas, and there are surgical extirpations that have been tried for some of these patients with some degree of success, then maybe they can be handled differently. There are other patients who have other named diseases, such as functional bowel disease. And nobody really can predict how the somatizer is going to focalize their individual disease. Some do it with GI, some do it with musculoskeletal, some do it with general affect, the chronic fatigue syndrome. Some do it with urinary problems, frequent urination and burning with urination with completely normal urines when they're examined. Another clue to a somatizer is that if there's a chat room on the internet, they probably have a somatizing syndrome. But I think that the incidence of somatization is high. I would estimate it at maybe 20% of the total ED population, which means you cannot get through a life of emergency medicine without having to interact with these patients. I think it's a mistake to assume that they're depressed and to invoke psychiatry, because I don't think they are depressed. I think they have a totally different problem. Now, that's not to say there aren't depressed patients who don't know they're depressed and who present with physical symptoms as opposed to concerns about their well-being or their feelings of depression. And that needs to be searched for, too. But I do not think that the somatizer is depressed, and I don't think psychiatry can offer them much of anything more than what I've already discussed. I think the second caveat is don't start another workup on these patients. Because once you do, you don't know where to stop. Every review of systems will give you 100% positives. And then how far are you going to investigate? How many sets of enzymes? What imaging studies that they haven't already had 400 times? And the last caveat is that even the somatizers get ill. So that one of the things that you do have to at least do quickly is listen to what they're saying about their symptoms. If they begin to add up to something that you recognize, then maybe you're dealing with a somatizer who actually has a problem like appendicitis. And that can certainly be difficult because the chances are you won't recognize it until after it's perforated. So having said that, I would guess that 95% of your encounters will work with just what can I do for you today? You have real problems, I can't fix them. And then the other 5% fall into those, the somatizer actually getting ill, or it's a combination of somatic disease with something else.
With everything that we have at our disposal now, we have coming up MRIs that are going to be more readily available. We have RNA biosignatures that are going to start to identify exactly the virus or exactly the bacteria in 2 to 4 hours instead of waiting for cultures. I mean, there's a test for anything that you want if you're willing to wait long enough. But for us in the ER, what we've discussed is that you can't make all those decisions for every single person per se, and you have to use some risk stratification. So we were eager to hear your perspective on how you deal with diagnostic uncertainty in the emergency department, specifically where it relates to advanced imaging.
Well, I think we need to step back and look at the process of making decisions in the emergency department, because it's quite different from the inpatient service, be it internal medicine, pediatrics, or any of the surgical specialties. So how is it different and how does it affect our decision making? It's different because if you start looking for a specific disease, you're going to make trouble for yourself. And the reason that we get so anxious about having diagnostic certainty is because we haven't gone through the mental logic of emergency medicine decision making, and because you can't prove a negative. So what is the correct logic? The correct logic is to not look for a specific disease. Your first tasks in emergency medicine are to measure the degree of difficulty of the next dive, if you will. How sick is this patient? Is the patient dying is the first question. There are only a finite small number of ways you die, maybe 4, okay? Is the patient on one of those pathways? And if the patient is, what do I have to do to get him off the pathway? Secondly, if the patient is not on a pathway to death, how sick is this patient? Is this a patient who looks and is probably so ill that they're going to require inpatient treatment? And then and only then can you start asking questions about how did they get here? Because the third most important question is, what's different today? What changed for this patient that made them come to the emergency department? It might be something as simple as time of day. A little illness in a child that's tolerable in the daytime becomes very scary at night, and added to having put up with it for many hours, can't tolerate it any longer. But that's still useful information in terms of how much anxiety are you going to have about this patient if you don't know the precise diagnosis. So that's number one. Number two, we're looking for diagnostic certainty via a logic that is inherently flawed from commencement. And that is, we have to use Bayesian logic about medical decision making. And Bayesian logic is, if there's not a high prior probability of the disease that you're looking for in the population that in which you're looking for it, there is no biologic test that performs with accuracy, be it an imaging study, be it a laboratory study. You only get false positives and false negatives, along with true information, and it's very hard to set out, but in terms of diagnostic certainty, it prevents it. The second thing is, even if we can remember the logic of how accurate any single test is, what we forget is, what is the value of the evidence of the test? For example, one of our major problems is ischemic coronary syndrome. Now, 10 years ago, maybe 20 years ago, the problem wasn't ischemic coronary syndrome, it was heart attack. For some reason, the awareness of what was a heart attack hadn't been codified, and we were struggling with doing it accurately. I think that the biologic tests for heart attack have now become helpful because we have a high prior probability in the population we're studying. So that's no longer the right question. The right question is not, is this patient having a heart attack? Because that's an easy yes-no answer today. But the tough question is this patient having an ischemic coronary syndrome? And sub-question A, if the patient is, then what do I need to do for it? And that's what leads to the diagnostic uncertainty. If we're comfortable diagnostically that the patient is having an ischemic coronary syndrome, we're not comfortable without an institutional protocol of what to do for that entity. And it varies from institution to institution. Inside some institution, it varies from cardiologist to cardiologist or primary care physician. And so we end up not feeling exactly sure what to do for the patient and thinking that yet another test will help us. So we move from our standard workup of acute coronary syndrome to coronary CT angiogram. And what we forget is, even if we move to the cath lab and do a specific coronary angiogram, we still end up with diagnostic uncertainty because there's no good rules and certainly no good evidence for which is the culprit vessel. And what the emergency physician doesn't see is that many patients get vessels stented that don't need to because they have a positive imaging study. So is it a false positive? Well, not in the usual sense of false positive. It's false positive in the sense that we don't know how to look at an imaging study and say this is what the disease is that's causing the patient's symptomatology. It's kind of like looking at a pneumothorax on a plain chest x-ray study. We don't know what the degree of pneumothorax is, even though we tend to put a number to it. We don't know what the pathophysiology is, whether we're dealing with tension pneumothorax. And all of the indirect findings that imaging gives us doesn't answer that question. It's a clinical question that can't be answered by an image. I think we need to go back away from feeling that if I have an image that is read as an X, then I'm dealing with an X, and that's diagnostic certainty. Lastly, we fool ourselves because we concern ourselves with a disease that probably isn't there, but we don't want to miss it. And then when we don't find it, we breathe a sigh of relief and we tell the patient, great, you don't have gallbladder disease. Well, the patient didn't think he had gallbladder disease in the first place and still wants to know why his stomach hurts. And often we overlook that because we now move back to the position that this patient looks okay to us, and we're happy that we've reached diagnostic certainty about gallstones, and we forget there's a zillion other entities that could be the culprit. So I think what we really need to start teaching is not so much how do I get people to order fewer tests and fewer imaging studies, but what's the quality of the evidence that we're going to get from any individual test? How is it going to alter my management of this patient? And if I can't answer that question, do I need that evidence?
I tell the residents a fair amount that one of the things that they need to consider is reassurance is one of the main reasons people come to the ER. They just want to know everything's okay. And there are those patients where they're reassured because somebody dressed like a physician has told them good news. It's not dangerous. And that can be accomplished with a history and physical. And they feel fine and want to know when they can go. And then there's other patients that say, well, how do you know? You haven't even done any tests. And so their trust is not placed in you, it's placed in the test. Even though they don't realize it's your interpretation of the test or a radiologist's interpretation of the test that's actually going to determine it. They have this kind of belief in an all infallible test that's going to let them know yes or no. How much weight do you put in the patient's desire for a testing modality to help relieve their diagnostic uncertainty?
I've perhaps encountered less of that than the present generation because I practiced for a long time before we had the tests. And so I got used to communicating my opinion of disease to the patient more than what the tests showed. I have had patients who simply have to have a study. There's something magical about having endured some x-rays that they can't go without. And frankly, I don't have the energy to fight with them. I don't think it's worth it. There are limits that I can set for myself. If a patient asked me to do a brain transplant, I would have no problem telling him, no, I'm not going to do that because it's A, not possible, and B, it's a silly idea for what's wrong with you. But if a patient wants a CAT scan for a kidney stone, and I know they've got one, I don't mind getting one for them because it isn't going to alter what I do for the patient. And I think part of that solution is we want to be reassuring to patients, but at the same time, we want to tell them what's wrong. This is how long it's going to be wrong. This is what you have to do to get better. This is how long it's going to take you to get better. And this is what you look for if you're not getting better. And this is what you do if you don't get better. In other words, we need to redesign our discharge instructions so that they're useful and they're more like a set of post-op orders than they are like a set of legal cover my because I know I've made a diagnostic error. So I agree with you. I think reassurance is significant, and I think that every patient comes to the emergency department with fear. Every patient is afraid of some diagnosis that they think they're having. And part of our job is to find out what is that fear and try to alleviate it.
I'm always kind of shocked when I go into a room and I meet someone for the very first time and start asking them about 30 seconds worth of questions and very quickly go into, so, do you smoke? Do you drink alcohol? Any drug use at all? Do you have sex with men, women, or both? It's just the crazy questions that we can ask people having really never met them before. So How do you recommend that we go about establishing this rapport with patients so that they trust us to take medicine, to undergo painful procedures, to follow up as we direct them to when we just met them?
It somewhat depends on how sick the patient is. When patients are dying, they trust you. And their family trusts you because they want help and you're giving it. And that's all the relationship you need. It's the patient who's less sick that doesn't trust you right away. And then it becomes a matter of what kind of a doctor are you? How do you form a professional relationship with somebody? If you just come in, take a 2-minute history, take a 2-second physical exam and never see the patient again, of course they don't trust you. But how do you greet the patient? How do you interact with them? When they're not that sick, I always start by something non-medical. In Boston, it's always safe to talk about the Red Sox. Whether it's good or bad, you can always establish a relationship with a patient by talking about the Red Sox or the Patriots. So what is it in your particular geography? Talk about the weather, you talk about rattlesnakes, something. Make a joke. Do something to make the patient feel that you care about them and you are a human being who wants to take care of them. I think that a lot of it has to do with the psychology of how much time you spend with them. Because I have spinal stenosis, I don't stand up very comfortably. So I've started sitting down when I take my history from patients. I don't spend 1 second longer with them, but simply the act of sitting down makes them think that I'm more interested in them and that I'm there with them longer. I always introduce myself to everybody in the room as well as to the patient. And if it's a younger patient, I usually start with the parents. But I also start with the child. I remember one of my favorite pediatricians, this guy I wrote many books with, called Roger Barkin. And Roger's a very tall, austere-looking man. And I remember I was visiting him one day at his hospital, and he got paged to the ICU for a kid who'd been admitted for, I think it was croup. And we went up there, and there was one of these typical scenes. The nurse was harassed. The mother was frantic. The kid was wailing. And it was one of these messy situations. And the mother started yelling at Roger, "Where have you been? You got the page 2 minutes before and couldn't possibly have answered it any quickly." He ignored her, and he went over to the child and said to the kid, "Give me a hug." And the kid put his arms around Roger, and the whole situation melted away. I was absolutely impressed. And it taught me a very good lesson, which is be a human being first, and a doctor second, and people will trust you.
That's really good. That's a good story, too. I've told some of the residents that, especially with parents, if the kid looks well, if your general gestalt is if the kid looks well, that 10 minutes sitting at bedside talking to them like a person will save you 3-4 hours of ED time and thousands of dollars worth of tests.
Yeah, if they think you know what you're talking about because you're a human being and you answer their questions and you really search out their fears. You can't just say to people, "What are you afraid of?" You got to find it out. And there is a fear. They're there not because the emergency department is an amusing place to come to. There are somatizers who believe that, but most people do not. And certainly most parents do not. And the father would probably rather be at home watching the football game, has gotten up to bring his kid in. They're afraid of something. What is it? Meningitis, cancer, who knows? Your job to find out. And you know the kid's not sick because he's destroying your exam.
So we hear a lot from different organizations, different podcasts, different emails that we get, ghost stories from our attendings about sticking to standard of care. We're also told that standard of care kind of changes depending on where you're at. So being that it's supposed to be standard, that's in the verbiage, who is it that actually sets standard of care? Is it our attendings? Is it our local legislature? Is it our colleges? Is it our professional organizations? Who is it that establishes this standard of care that we're held?
Well, you've pushed one of my buttons. I hate guidelines because they aren't guidelines, they're mandates. They start out in good intent. The society says, "I want to help my members to protect them from criticism in areas where it's not easy to manage patients, where there are lots of errors made, and if we can give them a safe practice that they can at least look at that practice and start from there, then they'll be more defensible. Instead of which, a group of guys sitting around a room, many of whom are very smart, many of whom are very experienced, and some of whom don't practice medicine anymore, come up with a set of rules that are all-encompassing, that don't fit any single patient, and really aren't useful guidelines, and you are free to ignore them. I don't think that you can define a standard of care. I think that doctors ought to stop worrying about a standard of care. It's a legal term. And whatever you think it is, they're going to think it's something else if it brings the money. And there's going to be a doctor who will come in and say, it is that other thing, because it brings him money. So forget about the standard of care. Think about, what is a safe practice? What do I need to do to make it safe for this patient? Can't be perfect. Without being perfect, how can I make it safe, make a minimum number of errors, and do what is necessary to make the patient feel better? Now, if guidelines help me to get started on a patient, then fine, use them. But don't rely on them as either protection or as a recipe for best care.
I've had the discussion with lots of people about how the other fields of commerce that people try to buttonhole us into of, well, emergency medicine should be more like airline pilots, or no, emergency doctors should be more like the hotel service industry, or different kinds of industries, and I just can't think of a good patient population or a good customer population that represents emergency doctors the way that an auto mechanic would be. I think we're the closest to auto mechanics, because you only go to the mechanic when something's wrong with your car. By the time you get there, it never is doing the thing that you were worried about it doing before, and you usually look fine. You have to make the noises you were making beforehand in order to explain it to them. You have generally little idea of what the mechanic is going to do. You have no idea how much it's going to cost, but you know that you're really upset that you're there. And I've tried to talk with some auto mechanics about this, and I've probably gotten better service on my car since then, but talking with them about it, it really is about getting people to trust you so that they trust your judgment, because there's no way you're going to give them a medical school education during the time they're in your ER.
I think the analogy to the airline pilot is an incorrect one in regards to, it's not comparable to the everyday responsibility of an airline pilot. The analogy was more comparable to the pilot at a time when something has gone disastrously wrong on the plane, and they have to call upon their years of experience to outride the disaster. Not unlike that moment that happened to the pilot in New York City. There's no way you could prepare for something like that. He had something like 2 minutes to figure out how he was going to salvage the plane and its passengers. And that is much more comparable to what a physician does. But all of these checklists work for the performance of a machine that has to work in a certain way. But we have to recall that the physician is not such a machine. And the process of medical decision making is not robotic or computer analysis capable. It requires a human judgment. And the more we try to remove the human judgment, the worse job we do, the more errors we make, the more it costs to practice a lower quality of medicine.
Kind of going along the same vein, We're going to be talking about pediatric fever in one of the months coming up, and there's a lot that's come out recently about new modalities of trying to figure out why a neonate would have a fever. We're doing a study here to figure out if we can get a 2 to 4 hour turnaround time for an RNA biosignature to determine if a child has a bacteria, a virus, both, or neither, which would be great, and it would be pretty revolutionary for what we do for kids as long as it works. A lot of what's coming out is newer algorithms for how to determine who's high risk, who's low risk, and the algorithms have changed along with the epidemiology. But you alluded to this earlier about you can't stick to an algorithm if this, then this for every patient, because at some point you have to be a physician. So with an algorithmic approach to emergency medicine, where do you see us having to steer away from what the algorithm says versus, okay, there truly is new epidemiology and we can't practice like we used to before vaccines, so here's a new way to train your mind to approach these well-appearing febrile children?
I think the utility of the algorithms is to teach you the parameters to investigate, but they don't substitute for clinical judgment, because you have to use clinical judgment as to whether or not the child scores in the algorithm. And if you're going to do that, you probably don't need the algorithm. I'm very opposed to this attempt to make medicine into a mathematical proof. Mathematics is not the practice of medicine, and it works for mathematics. It does not work for disease. And I have seen more errors made from a blind adherence to an algorithm that probably shouldn't have been attempted to be applied in the first place, when it was quite clear from the clinical presentation that the patient didn't belong in that algorithm. I'll give you an example. I attended an M&M conference at another university a number of months ago, and they had a patient they were presenting who was one of those sad cases of ALS who's gone beyond having any useful quality of life. This patient had been on a ventilator for almost 10 years, couldn't talk, don't know how much communication she had with relatives, and was essentially living in a skilled nursing home on a ventilator. Now, someone in a nursing home, and it was never explained why, thought that the patient was having vaginal bleeding. This was some 57-year-old woman. So they sent her in for an evaluation of vaginal bleeding. A quick pelvic exam would have said there is no vaginal bleeding, and back to the nursing home. Instead of which, they put her in the vaginal bleeding protocol for an otherwise healthy woman. And they sent off a urine which came back with a report that there were sperm in it. So then they introduced her into the rape algorithm. Now, I know that my gender isn't terribly concerned about who it will make love to, but there's no possible way that this woman could have been raped. Nevertheless, she started down this diagnostic pathway, and they kept finding things. And pretty soon, she got admitted because she had an elevated white count, and she had something wrong with her urine, and I forget what other 19 things they found. And after 2 weeks in the hospital, she expensively died. It turns out that the sperm in the urine was a misinterpretation by a computer reading of the urine analysis. And that's what I mean by blindly finding algorithms is going to increase our error making and lower the quality of our care. It's not going to improve it. There's no substitute for a good, thoughtful physician.
It's a terrifying story.
It's true. I still can't believe it's true.
Having practiced medicine for a while, having started the specialty, having been around the block once or twice. It's got to be interesting having seen medicine progress. Things that you used to do that you don't do anymore. Things that you used to witness on a daily basis that no one that we teach now has even heard of or has even attempted. Things like diagnostic peritoneal lavage. Some of these things are going away. But it's got to be fascinating for you as well. How have you seen medicine progress over your lifetime and over your career?
I gave a talk last week in Boston about art and science and medicine, which I probably ought to give here some time. As I look at science in medicine, it's different from what we know science to be in other major fields like physics or chemistry. We don't have a body of theory that's based on falsified experiments. What we have instead in medicine is a science of problem solving. If we look back during my lifetime and what we can do as physicians, what we couldn't do 80 years ago, it's pretty remarkable. In my lifetime, we have antibiotics, we have blood transfusions, we have all kinds of surgical procedures that didn't even exist, but which in fact are quality and quantity of life-saving. We have treatment of diseases that we had no therapies for. We have extension of diseases that used to be instant killers. And I think that on the whole, we've done a tremendous job in medicine. Obviously, we've had our disappointments. And obviously, some of the things that looked like they were going to be very promising have not evolved, like the human genome. That was really exciting. We were going to define disease by genetic analysis, and that was going to enable us to fix things that we had neither therapy for nor prevention for. And it was a wonderful idea. The problem is, the more we study genetics, the more we realize that knowing the genome isn't enough. We have to know the epigenetics. I heard a really fascinating lecture here a couple of years ago put on by the science department of the University of Arizona. They have a science series lectures every year. And the epigenetics is just fantastic because we don't know really what is genetic and what is chemical stimulus of a change in a genetic capacity or enabling a gene to express something it wasn't before then. Like I learned in microbiology in medical school that E. coli could not grow in a lactose medium because it was unable to secrete an enzyme called beta-galactosidase. Theoretically didn't have the enzyme for it. But lo and behold, when you put the E. coli into a lactose medium, there would be a drop in numbers, and then all of a sudden it would rise again to normal. And what had happened was the E. coli that had no ability to express beta-galactosidase and developed one. Was that a new gene mutation, or was it just an expression of a gene that was already there, the epigenetics? And I think it's the latter. And we certainly have experienced something similar with antibiotic resistance. So the science of medicine is still mostly oriented towards problem solving. And because of a lot of sociology and politics, we're no longer capable of attacking problems like we once did. So I think our new knowledge is going to slow down, and our problems are not going to be solved in a way that they need to be. And I think that's a shame. But maybe the pendulum will swing back someday. But overall, to answer your question, I'm very excited about what medicine has accomplished in my lifetime, and particularly in my lifetime as a physician. Yeah. Well, you can tell everybody.